In Memoirs of an Anti-Semite, Gregor von Rotzori's narrator looks back at a lifetime of hatred and wonders if he can turn the page on his past selves. Set largely during the rise of the Nazis in Germany, this striking 1979 satire led Elie Wiesel to say that Rotzori's voice echoes with the disturbing and wonderful magic of a true storyteller. Gregor von Rotzori is the subject of the fourth installment of our summer reading series devoted to underappreciated literature, and I'm very pleased that it brings Deborah Eisenberg back to the show. She wrote the introduction to the recent New York Review of Books reissue of this novel. Welcome to our show.
Thanks, Lenny.
When was Gregor von Rotzori born?
1914, I believe, in the Bukovina.
Mm-hmm. So that sounds, at least roughly, like the unnamed narrator in Memoirs of an Anti-Semite. Do we know whether this is a kind of autobiographical novel?
We kind of know whether it's kind of autobiographical. Certainly the narrators of these stories, sort of linked stories, share biographical characteristics with the author, but not all characteristics. I mean, for example, the narrator of the final story has a Jewish wife, or had a Jewish wife at a certain point. I don't believe that Grisha Rotzori ever did.
Well, he probably had affairs with Jewish women, at least suggested throughout this book. But it's interesting that the book is subtitled A Novel in Five Stories. And on some levels, it does feel like something we've seen more recently, these novels that aren't really novels. Interestingly also, the first four are in first person. The last one is in third person.
Absolutely. And the first four are set before World War II. And the final one is set, I believe it was both written and set in 79.
The novel was published in German in 1979, but the fourth chapter, Troth, had been published in English in the New Yorker a decade earlier.
Yes.
So do they all stand alone as well?
They all stand beautifully alone, beautifully alone. But the cumulative effect is simply stunning because they really do amplify each other.
How was the story received when it was published in The New Yorker?
You know, that's a marvelous question which I can't answer.
I'd imagine it would have stunned people.
It's stunning now. I'm sure it was stunning then.
He could write in both English and German, but he did write this book in German, didn't he?
I believe he wrote the whole thing in German, although he translated Troth himself. He may have written it initially in English, but I don't think so.
And then the rest is translated by Joachim Neugrischel, who's one of the leading translators of European languages out there. And you get a feeling when you read all five that Neugrischel really captured Rotzori's voice. So
yes, I think it's a very fine translation. Reading German myself.
Is his narrator an anti-Semite right off the bat on page one?
Well, yes. I mean, in a way, it's anti-Semitism itself embraces lots of subcategories, and really, he's just a child who's quite amenable to his father's virulent anti-Semitism.
And Zeitgeist pops up throughout the novel.
Throughout.
So he's just caught up in the anti-Semitic spirit of the age to some degree. And then, of course, the state-sponsored anti-Semitism during his life.
Yes, absolutely. Of course, he's also the narrator, although he's a sort of feckless fellow throughout, up until the last chapter, he's very, very clever. And he's clever enough to see through the anti-Semitism of the zeitgeist and of his relatives, to see it as a sort of threadbare and really preposterous, well, almost ideology. But he really can't. A lot of the book is devotes itself to his, in a way, trying fruitlessly to root it out of his soul. And at some point, I think he refers to himself as a fly caught in its web.
Well, he befriends a Jewish boy when he's growing up, and then he has relationships with Jewish women as an adult, although you get the feeling that he has sexualized them as a way of dehumanizing
Absolutely.
Them.
Absolutely. And, of course, really the... To me, the core of the book, its main tendency is to explore this feeling of dehumanizing, to make people other. It's very, very important to the book.
And it's, as much as anything, a look at a man's tortured examination of his own prejudices. But it's interesting that it's a satire.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's a satire, but it's also a satire based on passionate convictions.
We wondered if you would read a little bit from the book. We selected the opening of the last chapter.
Sure. I mean, I'd happily read the whole book if you had a few extra weeks. It is just, it's delicious.
Right? Let me tell everyone that my guest is Deborah Eisenberg, who wrote the introduction to a new edition of Gregor von Rotzori's Memoirs of an Anti-Semite, which has just been reissued in paperback by the New York Review of Books.
And I'd like to, before I just read this little bit, just to go back to what you were saying, it's a satire, but this section is so frankly anguished, you know, it'll just tear you to bits, really. So this chapter, if you will, or story, if you prefer, is called Pravda.
And this is the only one written in the third person.
That's correct. As if he were lost among the lotus eaters, he seemed to have forgotten his fatherland. What was this? Where did it come from? It had the rhapsodic intonation of memory, but he was not sure whether it was his memory, although grammatically it sounded as if it were. Even his memories could no longer be narrated simply in the murmuring imperfect tense. They required the resolutely indicated as if, the subjunctive, the mood of possibility. In any case, the shift into the indefinite, even if the occurrences had occurred from occurrences, the chain of motifs reached so deep into the past, reached back into the beginning of recorded time, the dawn of history, the golden haze of myth, where everything was open, any possibility. Only one thing was certain. Time was passing. Had passed, even if the occurrences had not assumed a visible shape. Time had slipped, kept slipping through the grip of memory, a great, great deal of time, and he had lived from the fullness of days as if they were inexhaustible, he especially. For it was not just one life which, these days, formed and would go on forming, not for much longer, he told himself, perhaps for 10 more years, at best 15, but a half a dozen different lives, lived in different eras, in different countries, in different languages, among totally different people. His name had had a different ring, had been pronounced in different ways. His costume had changed with his tailors and barbers, with the fashion of his environment. People he had met frequently 20 years ago could not for the life of them recall having made his acquaintance. He certainly looked different at 60, from what he had looked like at 40, at 20, a man with totally different characteristics. In the South, his gestures were livelier than they had been in the North. There he had smoked a pipe. Here, cigarillos. There he had drunk whiskey. Here, wine. There, a woman's shiny black hair had electrified him. Here, it was the fragrant mane of a blonde. To be sure, through all this, he had unshakably said, I, to himself. He had never felt any doubt as to his identity. He raised his eyebrows ironically whenever he heard or read the phrase that someone was seeking his identity, like some lost or never possessed object that was rightfully his. It gave him a sardonic pleasure when someone expressed perplexity or unfulfillment or disconnectedness to ask that person in the broadest American accent, you're looking for your lost identity, aren't you? Even though he himself could scarcely have indicated what constituted his own identity.
Deborah Eisenberg reading from Memoirs of an Anti-Semite, which has just been reissued by New York Review Press. And that was came as close to first person and third person as you can get. The narrator remembers his childhood as if it's a snapshot from a precision-engineered camera. And Christopher Hitchens wrote in a recent review of Memoirs of an Anti-Semite that Rosori treats this ultimate catastrophe, World War II, and the buildup to it in the mild language of understatement, which is what gives the novel, he says, so much of its shock. It's kind of, there's a distance, and at the same time, what we're seeing is the most shocking things.
Well, that is really the most extraordinary thing about this book, I think, is that up until the last section, he absolutely keeps a very pristine view of matters as though he were living right in them. I mean, for instance, it's very...
Even though he's talking about memories, we're very much in the present.
Very much in the present. He sort of flattens out the picture plane, so to speak. And it's... you know, in retrospect, it's very easy to see what a catastrophe is. A total devastation, a genocide. But while things are occurring, it's very, very, very confused, and people are leading sort of ordinary lives, and he's just kind of a little bit of a lazy guy who just wants to lead his private life.
Do we know what Rosori actually did during World War II?
I happen not to. I know that right after World War II, I believe he did radio work in Germany.
And then later went on to be a kind of a stateless actor and appeared in some films by Louis Malle.
Yes, I know he was screenwriting for Louis. I didn't actually know that he appeared in... I think he wrote the screenplay for Viva Maria.
Really?
Yeah, I think.
So he was in a movie with Brigitte Bardot and Jean Moreau.
He wrote it, I think.
Do we know if any of his other novels are available in English?
Yes, Anecdotage is available in English. Oedipus at Stalingrad, I believe, is available in English.
Have you read them? Are they as good
as this? Yeah, they're amazing. They're amazing.
Why do you think, when this book came out, it got a lot of attention and it got incredibly good reviews. And then it kind of disappeared. Why do you think books of this quality do disappear? Because perhaps it makes people uncomfortable to read them?
Well, I'm sure that that's one reason. But you're right, I think, that frequently really, really superb books, the best books, do disappear rather quickly. And I think it's because they're, you know, they're low margin. They have, at any given time, a small readership. The readership will exist in exactly the same proportion, so that cumulatively, you know, if they stay in print for 100 years, they'll have as many readers as anything else. But at any given time, it's a small readership.
And they have to keep on being reissued and reminding people, hey, I'm here.
That's right.
In his review, Christopher Hitchens also refers to the micro and macro versions of interwar anti-Semitism. Did you think about those two different kinds of anti-Semitism in this novel?
Well, I have to confess I haven't read that review, and I'm not quite sure what he means.
Well, perhaps the relationships with Jews that are of one kind of anti-Semitic nature, and then just that knee-jerk anti-Semitism that is there throughout the culture.
Well, all kinds of anti-Semitism show up in this book. Absolutely every kind, and many are mocked, and many are expressed in the narrator's life, and often both. He's mocking those that he can't help but express. But, of course, there's an absolutely wonderful phrase in one of the stories. The character's desperately anti-Semitic and happily anti-Semitic Viennese grandmother is walking down the street. And this is in Vienna after Anschluss. I think it's German Nazis who have sort of taken over. And they're beating up a doctor whom she recognizes. The doctor has treated her sister for something. And she, the proper Viennese anti-Semitic lady, attacks these bullies with her umbrella and says, now this is going too far. And it's such a marvelous phrase, going too far, because, of course, implicit is that there's a going far enough.
There's an acceptable anti-Semitism.
Yeah, yeah.
We've been talking about Gregor von Rizzori's Memoirs of an Anti-Semite, just recently reissued by New York Review Books. It's part of our underappreciated literature series for this summer. And my great thanks to Deborah Eisenberg, who wrote the introduction and who's been talking with us about it.
Thank you, Lenny.